Imagine it with me, this community of friends, what the text calls disciples, which means devoted students. Imagine each of them had met this incredible person. This person with such a compelling vision, they felt inspired to completely reorient their lives. They had left all they'd known, their careers, their families, all to follow this wandering teacher. I mean, he must have been something, right? Jesus had taught them and trained them as the keepers of a new vision, heralds of a new kingdom. They'd spent all this time with him, following him, teaching with him and about him, telling about him and his way. And then with his death, it was just over. Done. I mean, they must have been torn up, wondering, what should they do now? I mean, what did all that mean? When I think about these sorts of people in my life, I mean, not Jesus level exactly. But still, there have been those people who have caused me to reorient my life. The sort of person that makes you switch majors or even careers, or inspires you even to sell your house, move to a new town, maybe even give away all your things. Someone who leads you to become a whole new person, or sets you on the course of becoming the person you were always meant to be. This is who Jesus was to his disciples. And in the few days before the part of the story that Howell read, this life, this inspiring, life-changing person had died. In fact, he had been executed terribly, without much fanfare, even like a common criminal. It had to have made them wonder if the whole thing was just like a big lie. Right? I mean, there would have been grief, of course. The loss would have been huge, felt in their bones. But even more, I have to imagine that his death would have felt like a betrayal. I mean, was he actually who he said he was? Was he not the person they'd believed him to be? Was his message unworthy of all those life changes, unworthy of their dedication and loyalty? Was it all a bunch of woo-woo, let's all love each other, bunch of baloney? I love this part of the story. I mean, it's terrible, but it is so relatable. I mean, how many times in your life have you wondered if this whole human goodness and kindness, love above all stuff was foolish, naive? Recipe for lifelong heartbreak. How many times have we all conceded to cynicism in the name of pragmatism? How often have we all felt like we might as well give in, give up our ideals of compassion and equality, that we need to be more realistic, do a better job of simply looking out for number one? Too often. Lately, much too often. This is how I imagine the male disciples felt after Jesus died. Grief-stricken and betrayed. Lost. Their whole world was turned upside down. They couldn't see the way forward. It was just over. The female disciples, on the other hand, they may or may not have been feeling the same way, but they decided to take up the necessary practical details nonetheless, which is interesting. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them, how many and who exactly, we don't know. All of these went on to the place where Jesus' body had been laid to rest, went on with their spices and their cloths to tend to the body as was their custom. And what they found there was confusing, disorienting, shocking. The stone in front of the tomb had been rolled away, and Jesus' body was not there. The story goes on to say that Jesus had risen or awoken, that in fact he lived on. Now, we tend to get tripped up at this point in the story on the question of did this really happen? Is it historically accurate? This can be interesting scholarship, and it can be liberating for those who have been oppressed by an insistence on a literal interpretation. But the more compelling question for me about this story is more about why these Christian communities, two generations after Jesus had died, which is when this story from Luke from his gospel was actually likely written 50 or 60, maybe even 70 years after Jesus died. Why did they tell the story this way? Why did they tell this story? I mean, what does it mean, or rather, what gift does it offer us today that these nascent Christian communities decided to tell the story this way? And rather than simply letting the story end at the tomb or with the reality of their grief and loss, their betrayal, which was also very true. We always have a choice about how we will tell our stories, and a choice about which pieces of the story we will live from and out of, upon which truths we will be willing to stake our lives. We can get caught in a certain version, unable to see the fuller story, especially stories from our childhood. We can get caught there. It can be so interesting to go back and ask our parents to tell us again about something we think we know exactly accurately from our growing up years, which we do, just only from the perspective of that kid, the perspective of one without a lot of control or total information, but whose life was nonetheless impacted. So too with religious communities, whether 2,000 years ago or today, we have stories we tell, sometimes about the same time period, same basic situation, yet depending on who, which one of us might be telling the story, it can seem like entirely different, even contradictory narratives. Yet each is in some ways true. So again, we decide. Which story will we live out of? What compels me about the Easter story is the way that it refuses to allow the tomb or the grief and loss and betrayal to have the final word. Which is not to say that it didn't matter that Jesus died. I mean, there is plenty of telling about Jesus' death in the scriptures, although you might not know that if you only know the story by way of a Unitarian Universalist church, right? Just out of curiosity, I want to show of hands if you're willing. For those of you that have been coming to Foothills for more than a decade, how many of you have attended a Good Friday service? I mean, here. Yeah, it's good, absolutely. Yeah, we are pretty resilient in our engagement with the Easter story in one way or another. We do tend to come back each year to this story of resiliency, transformation, and new life that's represented so well in the resurrection. But we do tend to skip over the parts of the story and then the rituals that go with them that lead to the reason that Easter was such good news. Again, it's interesting, the parts of the story we lift up and those we leave out. Our liberal religious orientation to hope, to affirming that everything is going to be just fine, has sometimes led us to skip over the rituals of loss or betrayal, those darker parts of humanity, whether we're talking about Good Friday or life in general. But we know that not addressing our tomb experiences, as Diana called them last week, it doesn't make our long nights or our piercing need for the morning light go away. In fact, it's usually the opposite. What we ignore grows, overtakes us, fails to heal, gets passed on, Until we look critically at our struggles of the past, our history will continue to darken the pathways of our future. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived, but if faced with courage, need not be lived again. Still, more than his death, in the way the story has come to us, it is clear that it mattered to his followers that Jesus lived. More than that he died, it mattered that he lived, whether before or after his crucifixion, it mattered that he lived in a real body, a human body. In the chapters that follow the passage we read today, it goes on to describe how the resurrected Jesus had real muscles and real bone and ate real food. It seems to me so important that this story be not about a ghost visiting the still living or a spirit that continues on, but a body, a real life. Telling it this way underscores that it was always his life, his embodied life, that mattered. It was not that he lived in some other realm or ruled in some other life, but the promised land was already here in this life, on this earth. Telling it this way says that it was not his death that mattered most. His death did not make reorienting their lives make sense. Only his life was worthy of such devotion. It was his presence, his real life presence, his sometimes impatient, overly idealistic, miraculous healing, sitting down for a meal and telling a good story sort of presence. It was his life that he truly lived that finally mattered. By telling the story this way, the early Christian communities were themselves defying death's power, defying the power of the empire to put Jesus to death, defying his life from being reduced in meaning to the pain of his death. They were insisting his life was about life. Much has been made of this resurrection story over these 2,000 years. I mean, much meaning, whole religious systems created and revised and reformed. But as I was thinking about all of this for this morning's Easter service, I just kept coming back to this simple idea that this story and the way that it is told, what it proclaims, which is that even after the worst has happened, there is still the possibility of life. That it's life that matters. Even when we're sure we've been foolish or naive, even when we've lost our way, even when everything is turned upside down, somehow, even then, joy, surprise, awe, and celebration remain possible. Beyond the doctrine, the dogma, the questions of historicity or science, beyond denominational distinctions or theological implications, this is the good news of Easter, that the tomb is not the only way to tell life's story. That in addition to grief and loss and struggle, life persists and continues on, and the morning light still arrives as a gift. This is what I think the women understood. In the midst of everything being turned upside down, life still goes on. The story of Easter does not attempt to erase loss or prevent it. It doesn't make everything all better. As my colleague Jake Morrill puts it, on Easter morning, those who loved Jesus were amazed, puzzled, awestruck, but they were still in trouble. Rome was still in charge, and they were at least 2,000 years from glory, maybe more. Easter does not ask us to pretend that we aren't still in trouble either, that our world isn't still in trouble, that our hearts aren't still grieving or struggling, that so much of the world is not broken. Easter only asks us not to be wedded to fear or yoked to brutishness, but instead to live out the promise of new life, still being created here again and again. Easter asks us to live, even in the face of great heartbreak, with gratitude that we are still breathing, that we are still moving and loving and giving, that we have the strength to keep walking forward, to sing as Judy Fiel sings, I still have joy, I still have joy. After all the things I've been through, I still have joy. Easter asks us to say to one another through it all, good morning. Let's say that. We just turn to your neighbor for a second. Just say, good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Easter says nothing can take away my joyous celebrating heart, my heart for life. Good morning. For all of us who are trying to live awake, for all of us attempting with all our might to love this difficult world, attempting to keep up with the news, for each of us who find there are too many stories of violence or tragedy, for all of us who put it in a box and set it aside so that we don't have to take it all in, we for whom it is all too much, we whose bodies and truth are under assault in North Carolina, and on the streets of every neighborhood across our country, including our own. We who fear for our children, for the earth, who wrestle with depression or debt or addiction. We who know the edge of cynicism or despair. We all have this urgent, piercing need for this bright morning. And Easter says, lift up your faces. And live out of this story, this great possibility that this day dawns for you, for everyone. Alleluia. Alleluia. And good morning.